Anyway, so you said before the break, you would have heard that reading from the Dhammapada, from the chapter on the way, and this is where the title of this talk comes from. The first, or the second line of that verse is, best of truths are the four truths. So I'll just read the whole verse. It says, best of ways is the eightfold way, best of truths are the four truths, passionlessness is the best of mental states, the man of vision is the best of bipeds. I often just translate that as best of the two-footed. Biped, I always think of mopeds, and I think of that biped. Biped just means a being that walks on 2 feet, as opposed to a quadruped. But it's one of these words that I've never come across except in translations of the Dhammapada. So that's what that means, if you're wondering earlier on, what's a biped? So the man of vision is the best of bipeds. So right from the beginning of this little chapter of the Dhammapada, you get this notion of best, of something being best. So immediately it's saying that some paths are better than other paths, some truths are better than other truths, some mental states are better than other mental states, even some people are better than others in the sense of being more developed. So it's really saying that there are perspectives that are deeper, that are truer than other perspectives. So yeah, like I say, some truths are better than others. Some things go to the heart of things more than others. So it's really stating, and in a way, it's quite important, I think, just to really take stock of the fact that what the Buddha is saying is that deeper levels of understanding of life are possible. That's what he's saying. There's a hierarchy, there's development that's available to us. So I think that's quite important that we recognise that there is truth out there that we can realise, and that this is very much the sort of Buddhist approach, that the spiritual development is possible, that knowledge about the truth of things can be attained. So these four truths, they're just literally called, in that little chapter, four truths. They're more commonly known, and you're probably familiar with them, as the four noble truths. So noble here is not an honorific. It's not just a mark of respect that these are really important and they've got a long history, so we better give them a little title, call them noble, if you see what I mean. What that word means is actually a translation of the word Aryan. And Aryans are people who see things as they really are. They're stream entrants and beyond. So the people have actually had an immediate understanding of the way things really are. So the four truths, the four Aryan truths, are the way in which the Aryans see things, the way they see the world. So that, I think that's quite important that we catch that. It's not just that they're special or important. They are special and important, but they're special and important because they offer a perspective that is deeper than ours. And that stream entrant, somebody who's entered the stream that leads to awakening, is another word for, at least the man of vision, or the person of vision, who's the best of the two-footed, is a stream entrant. And they're called, man of vision or person of vision, the word is chakuma, which literally means the one with the eye. I rather like that, the one with the eye. And the particular eye that's been spoken about here is the eye of the Dhamma. And the spiritual development or unfoldment is spoken of in one tradition as being the progressive opening of five eyes. So first of all, you've got your fleshly eye, which is the one that, you know, we see through in the ordinary kind of way. And then they've got the divine eye, which is like a kind of a the sort of eye that can sort of see clairvoyantly and so on. It's an eye that comes with the development of higher states of consciousness. And then there's the Dharma eye. This is the eye that arises in stream entry. There's also the eye of wisdom, the Prajna Chakku, or Panya Chakku, that arises with arahantship. And there's also the eye of the Buddha. So often you hear accounts of the awakening of the Buddha, and you hear that the Buddha talking about surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha. You might be familiar with that phrase. And he sees, for example, beings arising and passing away in accordance with their actions and so on. So there's these five eyes. So you're not just... this perspective that the Four Noble Truths is communicating comes from a person, a man or a woman, whose eye has opened, their Dharma eye has opened. They've seen things as they really are. so this is what they see when they try and communicate their experience. So that's just a little bit about the word noble in this context, the Four Noble Truths. I'll talk about the notion of truth at the end, because I think that's also quite an interesting notion, the notion of truth. So what are they, the Four Aryan Truths, the Four Noble Truths? What I'll do is I'll just read from the sutta. It's the sutta that's called the First Turning of the Wheel of the Dhamma. So this is, according to tradition, is the teaching that the Buddha gave first. Yeah, so he travelled to find his five former companions, and when he met them, this is the content of what he was said to have communicated to them, the so-called first discourse. This is not the whole thing, it's just an excerpt. And he's talking to bhikkhus, so the bhikkhus are these five monks. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Illness is suffering. Death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this noble eightfold path, that is, perfect view, perfect intention, perfect speech, perfect action, perfect livelihood, perfect effort, perfect mindfulness, perfect concentration. So that's what the Buddha says about the Four Noble Truths. So the first is the truth of suffering. Second is the truth of the cause of suffering, which is craving. The third is the truth of the cessation of suffering, which comes with the cessation of craving. And the fourth is the path or the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So I'm just going to go through each of them in turn and say some stuff about them. So it's interesting, in the first one, the dukkha, dukkha is the word that's translated as suffering, dukkha. The Buddha doesn't really, he just basically gives examples of experiences that we have in life. He's just saying that these things are things that happen. so there's eight different things that he lists. So there's birth, aging, illness, death. So he says they're suffering, they're painful. He's not saying anything, he's not saying that they're only suffering, because obviously birth is an amazing thing, you know, it's a beautiful thing, but it's painful for both parties. That's fair to say, isn't it? birth, aging, illness, death, union with what is displeasing. Yeah. So feeling cold, feeling too hot, and a million and one other examples that one could think of. Separation from what is pleasing. Yeah, the sun comes to an end. etc. Not get what one wants. It's interesting that it's quite sort of down to earth in a way. You don't get what you want and it's suffering. You go to your favourite cafe and they've run out of almond buns, so you have to have a cherry bun instead, for example. You know, I mean, that's a frivolous example, but you can extrapolate yourself. And then it says, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. So, yeah, so the first seven are just occasions of pain, painful occasions in our life. So it's not a sort of a metaphysical statement. It's not, in a way, not even really being philosophical. It's just saying that these things happen. These are facts. And they're troubling facts. I remember when I was a kid, it's a little story now, I was told, my mother would say to me, Ben, life isn't fair, you know, she used to tell me this. And I used to fight with her. I didn't fight with her out loud. I used to fight with her in my own mind. I used to try and make it fair. And for example, there was a boy who lived down the road, and his father owned the dairy. So what you call here like a corner shop, you know, where you buy your milk and your bread and your cheese and whatever, those kind of things, that we in New Zealand, for some reason, we call that a dairy. In Australia, they call it a mixed business. Or a mixed business. Anyway, that's what I digress. But we call it a dairy. And this boy, Brendan, who lived in the dairy, every day in his lunchbox he got a creamed donut. And I didn't get a creamed donut. And I didn't think that was fair. But I was able to make this kind of like... I was able to make this kind of thing in my mind. Oh, well, he gets a cream donut, but I've got, you know, like, you know, I can't remember what it was, but, you know, like, I've, you know, my dad's an engineer, or I don't know what it was, but I was able in my, you know, 7-year-old brain, my 7-year-old mind, to make it fair that Brendan got a cream donut and I had, you know, jam sandwiches and a banana. And furthermore, I had jam sandwiches that tasted like banana, because the banana was always pushed up next to the sandwiches. Anyone remember that? Mm-hmm. And that was dukkha. That was, you know, union was something that I found displeasing. I really, really hated sandwiches that tasted like banana. But anyway, but then there's this kid, and I was able to make it fair that, you know, yeah, he got a cream donut, but I had all these other things that he didn't have. But then... I remember at a similar time in my life, this would have been the early, mid-80s, there was famine in Ethiopia. You probably remember the images on the television if you go back that far. That was when, you know, there was Live Aid and Bob Geldof and all of that. And I remember finding that really, really troubling, because I couldn't make my life fair. It just didn't seem fair at all. I couldn't... If you sort of see what I mean, I sort of look at those kids, you know, starving, and I thought, that's just not fair. You know, there's no way I could do a trick in my mind to make my life and their life fair. I couldn't do it. So there's something sort of unredeemable about that situation. I kind of felt humiliated by it, that I couldn't make it okay. And I think that's what the Buddha's talking about. He's saying that there are certain aspects of life, no matter how you... whatever mental gymnastics you do, you can't make them okay. They're dukkha. They're unsatisfactory. They're suffering. And that's what he's getting at, I think. He's just saying, yeah, there's these things in life that you just can't get around. Well, we can, but that comes next. The last one, he says, you know, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. So this is a little bit more metaphysical. This is sort of saying, yeah, there's always occasions of suffering, but then there's this deeper issue, which is we're attached, we cling to the conditioned world. And because of that, we're kind of boxed in. We're incarcerated by this clinging. We can't let go. We can't let things be the way they are. We kind of grab onto things. We grab onto particular kinds of experiences. We grab onto particular experiences of form and hear things that we hear, things that we taste, things through the body, particular feelings, pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, particular ideas that we have. We cling on to that, and that's just it's suffering. The fact that we're just conditioned and we're stuck in this conditioned world and we can't let it just arise. We grab on, we cling. So this is a kind of a deeper thing, and the Buddha, this is really annoying. I've got a book in my bag that I was supposed to read from, but I forgot it. It's Talk 101. When you give a Dharma talk, make sure you've got the book that you're going to read from. Anyway, I'll just tell you what it is. Basically, there's a story where the Buddha says, he says, what has been greater? The tears that you have shed through all the people that, all the grief that you've experienced in all of your lives, or the water in the four great oceans? What is greater? And the answer is, the water that you have shed through your tears through all of your lifetimes is greater than the water of the four oceans. So this is a kind of a deeper sense of dukkha, that we're tangled up in this conditioned world and we keep living in this conditioned world and keep having to experience this dukkha over and over again because of that entanglement. And of course, you know, there is this idea, a central idea in Buddhism, that this has been going on for lifetimes, since beginningless time. So it's not just here and now. It's something. So you know, in a former life, I was that boy and or girl in Ethiopia or somewhere else who didn't have enough to eat. Do you know what I mean? So this is the kind of deeper thing that the Buddha is pointing to. This being tangled up with the endless round is dukkha. And particularly in Indian Buddhism, they seem to really emphasize this notion of dukkha as being like toil, that we're constantly reborn in, and we just have to toil, we have to work, we have to, you know, work really, really hard just to kind of keep our head above water. And that goes on and on and on for lifetime after lifetime. So that might sound a bit extreme, but I think one thing to recognize is that There's an element of dukkha. There's an element of this dis-ease right here and now. There's a little niggle in our heart, or it might be a big niggle, a vague restlessness, a disquiet, a sort of dissonance or a dis-ease or a fear. And it's sort of there niggling us a lot of the time, maybe all of the time. And part of that arises just from the knowledge that, you know, our life is finite. We're only here for a short time, and we can't completely forget about that. The poet Philip Larkin he talks about death in one of his poems. He says, "This is a special way of being afraid. No trick dispels. Religion used to try that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die." So, in a sense, what the Dharma is doing, what the Buddha's teaching is doing, is just in a way, kind of making that experience conscious, acknowledging that is actually an experience that we have. We feel disease, and with it often arises a sense of fear. So again, I mean, we didn't do this puja earlier, we did a different puja, but in our sevenfold puja we do say, standing before them with hands raised in reverence and terrified of suffering, I pay salutations again and again. And some people don't like that, but I think that's dead on, actually. I mean, if you really, there's just something kind of really fearful about the whole thing. And I think it's important just to acknowledge that and just acknowledge it as a reality. I'll read you a little bit more from Philip Larkin. It's a poem called Obard, which I think is nihilistic. I think he's got a nihilistic outlook. He doesn't believe in a transcendent, liberating principle like the principle of awakening. He doesn't seem to believe in that. But he does seem to have a very, very keen awareness of death and what does life mean in the face of it. So he goes on a little bit. I'll just read you this a little bit because it makes it quite vivid. "And so it stays just on the edge of vision, a small, unfocused blur, a standing chill. that slows each impulse down to indecision. Most things may never happen. This one will. And realization of it rages out in furnace fear when we are caught without people or drink. Courage is no good. It means not scaring others. Being brave lets no one off the grave. Death is no different whined at than withstood. So yeah, a much deeper solution is required. A much deeper solution is required. And the next truth talks about the cause of dukkha. And this, of course, is craving. Yeah? So craving is the second noble truth, the truth of craving, or the truth of the cause of suffering, which is craving. And it's quite easy, I think, for that to sound a little bit banal, craving. And I think part of that is usually when we use the word craving, we talk about it in relation to, like, chocolate or sex or films or various sense pleasures. So it's interesting. I looked it up in the dictionary, and it says, and this is the Oxford Dictionary, it says, craving, a powerful desire for something. And you know, often in a dictionary, it gives you a little example in a sentence, and the example is a craving for chocolate. And you get this, it reminded me of a song by Rufus Wainwright, who's a Canadian singer-songwriter. It's called Cigarettes and Chocolate Milk. The words go, cigarettes and chocolate milk, these are just a couple of my cravings. Everything it seems I like a little bit stronger, a little bit thicker, a little bit harmful for me. So that's often when we talk about craving, it's in that context. So I just wanted to highlight that, because I think the Buddha is talking about that, but he's also talking about some other stuff, which I'll mention in a moment. So this is what he actually says in the sutta I read at the beginning. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for extermination. Or sometimes it's translated craving for non-existence. So there's three different kinds of craving. So the first one is craving for sensual pleasures. So it's kama, trishna. And this word, I'll come on to that in a second. This is the first time it's sense pleasure. It's wanting pleasure through the senses. You notice this often, most keenly, when you don't have recourse to it. So if you go on retreat, you're taken away from your usual sources of pleasure, whether that's reading or various kinds of food or a million other one things that you know yourself what they might be. So you often notice that craving when the object of your craving is not available to you, and you feel a kind of ache. Like the poet says, like Larkin says, you know, when you're caught without people or drink. So people, companionship, can be a certain kind of sensual craving. You just to be with other people, to feel safe with other people, the sort of herd mentality. So that's the first kind of craving, and it's the cause of dukkha, because in order to have the pleasure, you also end up creating the conditions to have the pain. So if you've got senses, you experience pleasure through the senses, but you also experience pain through the senses. So in a way, you can't have one without the other. It's one of those difficult facts of life. You know, if you have a body, you experience the pleasure of sitting outside on a sunny day, and you also experience the pain of getting the flu. They're both aspects of the same reality of having a body. So that's the first kind of craving, is craving for sensual pleasures. And often we experience them most strongly when we feel a bit insecure, when we get in touch with that small, unfocused blur at the edge of vision, as the poet calls it. When we feel that disease, we often, one way of dealing with that, a direct way, is to kind of reach after some kind of pleasure. The second one is bhava trishna. Craving for existence. And it's probably worth noting here that the word craving literally means something like hunger or thirst. So the word, you know, is literally thirst. Sometimes I think of it as kind of longing. It's this very, very deep hunger that we have for experience. And what this is about is just hunger for existence. We just crave for existence. It's like it was almost like a sense of I'll do anything. I just want to exist, or I'm just going to keep going and hope for the best. So it's the pull of the familiar. I think that's what's being talked about here. Just a deep desire, a deep thirst to just kind of keep things going in a way that we're familiar with, because it helps us to feel secure, even if at a certain level we know that it doesn't actually kind of work. I've got another little example from a poem. I'm not going to read you the whole poem because it's kind of long, but it's a poem about a man who is with his friend who's dying of AIDS. So it's quite a difficult poem, and it's, well, in a way you could say it's a poem about dukkha and a poem about impending loss. Basically he takes him out for a meal, and he describes meeting him, taking him out for a meal, and then taking him home, and then catching the streetcar back. It's set in San Francisco. It's called the J car, which is the name of the particular tram that he was riding. It's a poet called Tom Gunn. So I'm just going to read four lines. So you can imagine two men, one of whom is dying of AIDS, having a conversation at a restaurant. Our conversation circumspectly cheerful. We had sat here like children, good but fearful, who think if they behave, everything might still, against likelihood, come out all right. So I think that's sometimes the way we live. We just kind of put our head down and hope for the best. And just kind of keep the whole show going without really thinking about how what we're doing is going to relieve our dukkha. I think that's what this is pointing to. And it's a really, really deep thing. I remember, again, a little memory, seeing my grandmother on her deathbed, and she was very, very far gone into dementia. So much so that it felt like all that remained was just this desire to remain. It was really quite a strange experience to see her. It's like that was all that was left, was just, she just wanted, I just felt this really, really, really strong desire to just to keep staying there, just keep being there, and an unwillingness to just let go into what was next. I mean, I don't know what her experience was, but that was a really, really strong feeling I got, that this sort of raw thirst just to exist was just about all that was left. Quite strange and a little bit disturbing to be with her. More difficult for my father. Anyway, so this is what I think this is pointing to. I'm trying to, what might this thirst for existence amount to? Then there's thirst for extermination. It's kind of like, really? Do we really want to be exterminated? I think what this is, you know, sometimes in life you just get this really strong feeling, which is like, oh, just make it stop. Make it stop. You just want the whole of experience just to stop. You're sick of it. And I do think it can be a bit of a reflex of the Bhava Trishna. You're kind of in this groove, you're going along, and you can feel the crampness of it. And part of you just feels like you just want it to stop. You just want everything just to cease. So I think it's a kind of a reflex of Bhava Trishna. That's my interpretation, by the way. You just can't bear the kind of grinding repetitiveness of it. A little story. I remember hearing neighbours having a fight. You know, when you live in the terrace housing, you can hear your neighbours fighting. And it was a man and a woman, and we'd hear them fighting late at night. And one of them would be going hammer and tongs at the other one, like really throwing everything at him, the whole kitchen sink. Resentments obviously going back years. And the other guy, the other party, would just say, "Would you stop? Would you stop?" Is all he could say. It's kind of funny. It was actually really quite painful to listen to this sort of really, I mean, word failure stuck situation. But that, I think that's kind of, it felt like that was what was going on. It's just, you just want the experience just to cease. So the most obvious extension of that, the most obvious action which expresses that, it will be a suicidal intention, where you the only solution you can come to in your mind is to just cut it off, to stop it. So I do wonder if, and these are kind of musings now, but I do sometimes, when I was writing this, I did wonder if, sometimes you hear people have got an obsession with being in the now. You know, like, that is what their life is about, is being in the now. And they get really concerned. It's like, sometimes you meet people in meditation courses and they're like, I just couldn't be in the now. As if you're able to get into the now, wherever that might be, everything will just stop. So I do wonder if this can be. I mean, I think it's really good to be present. You know, obviously that's really valuable, to just be really deeply aware and fully present and wholeheartedly doing what you're doing. But sometimes if it becomes obsessive, it's almost like, I think, can be a desire for this kind of cessation of experience, that it, you know, you just want it to all stop. I mean, I remember having sort of, again, a kind of a notion when, I think this can often happen when, you know, I'm just going to go and live in a monastery in the mountains. You know, life's a bit difficult, and I'm just going to go and live in a monastery in the mountains. Like, that would just solve everything. You know? Like, it's sort of like a vision of life where everything just kind of stops. So some people will probably be more prone to one than the other, and I think it's quite interesting to reflect on what your particular kind of craving might be. Yeah? So do you sort of see that what's going on here is something that's quite, is much deeper than just fancying, you know, a Snickers bar. And it's something that we do. It's something that it's not a force that's external to us. And I think this is really, really crucial. Again, it's sort of something that we can overlook. You get so familiar with the Four Noble Truths, you can just kind of overlook it. But this cause of suffering is not a force that's external to us. It's not a kind of external agent. It's something that we're, there's something in here. There's something that we're doing. That's things that we say and things that we do that arise from our heart. So, you know, we're all aware that in other traditions, suffering is caused by an external agent. So it might be a punishment from God for wickedness, or it might arise as from possession by a malevolent force like the devil. In a secular context, it might be caused by bad politicians. But so you can see how it gets externalized quite easily. It gets kind of projected outwards. And I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I can't remember how we got onto the topic. Actually, no, I was talking about this. I was talking to him. Because I was talking about this talk and what I was thinking about saying, and just checking that he thought it was all right. He's got more experience than me. But he was talking about this movie that he saw when he was much younger. And he was saying how he had this really strong fear when he was a younger man. He's now probably in his, what would he be, in his early 50s, that he could be possessed by a kind of malevolent force. It used to really freak him out. And he's talking about seeing this movie, which some of you might have seen, is called Angel Heart. It's Robert De Niro basically plays Lucifer. Mm-hmm. And there's this one scene where he is eating an egg. And he's kind of rolling the egg to take off the shell on a plate. And he kind of holds it up. He's got these long fingernails. And he says, in some traditions, the egg represents the soul. Mm-hmm. And then he puts it in his mouth and eats it. And my friend told me that when he saw that, he was utterly freaked out by it. Mm-hmm. He's actually quite, like, he's not, like, I mean, I was really surprised at that, because he's very sensible and quite kind of grounded. And I was really shocked, but he said he was utterly terrified by that image in that movie of Lucifer, the devil, eating somebody's soul in the form of this egg. And he was saying how he was reading the Bodhisharyavatara, which is a Buddhist text, and he read this part about how it's your own mind that casts you into heaven or hell. And he said that was like an absolute relief to him to hear that. And he said he, on a solitary retreat, he just said it out loud over and over again. Because, again, he could see the truth of that. So that, you know, I'll say more about that in a minute, but that's the power of truth, that you actually, it's liberating. He was liberated from this sort of morbid fear of being possessed by some kind of malevolent spirit. He realized, no, it's my own mind that will lead me into a state of extreme suffering or a state of happiness. And so, you know, it was an intense relief to him. But of course, you know, if you accept that, of course, you have to take responsibility for what goes on in your mind. You know, that's the rub. You know, but that's the radical aspect of this teaching, is it's saying, you know, you have got the power to do something about this. You don't have to entreat some kind of external agent or external force to liberate you, to make you safe. It's up to your own actions, what you think, and what you say, and what you do. So that's just a little bit about the second noble truth, the truth of, well, let's call it Trishna, as a cause of dukkha, and how it's got these three aspects, or these three different elements of craving for sense pleasure, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence or extermination. So the third truth is... the truth of the cessation of suffering. I must confess that when I first came across this, the word cessation confused me because I never heard it really used before. It wasn't until quite a long time afterwards I realised what it actually meant. It literally, I looked it up again, it says the fact or process of ending or being brought to an end. So you could say it's ending, it's finishing, it's stopping. So this is what the Buddha says. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. So what is subject to arising is also subject to cessation. So that means that craving is a conditioned phenomena, and it can come into being and it can also cease, in the same way that suffering can come into being and it can also cease. So it's kind of, what can be off-putting about this is put negatively. You know, it's the ending of something. What is the ending of is suffering, but it doesn't posit something positive. However, we need to remember that this is a teaching of the Buddha. So if the Buddha was telling you that, well, the Buddha would be telling you that. He'd be there embodying that same state of the cessation of craving. And I think, again, this is why maybe a lot of us find this teaching a little bit off-putting. It sounds very negative. Mm-hmm. And why it's so important that we have a really positive feeling for the Buddha when we engage with the Dharma, particularly teachings like this. But, you know, that's why, you know, we meditated and then we did a puja. So a puja is a way of developing a sense of and a feeling for and a conviction in that the Buddha as the awakened one, the fully, perfectly enlightened one, and to actually awaken and express those feelings of reverence, like an actual connection with that, with what that might be. You know, I think this is what... And one question is to ask oneself, I think, is what would it be like to stop craving? What would it be like if that dis-ease, that dissonance, that niggle, that niggling, which can be intense, what if that wasn't there? Sometimes I feel this phrase in a puja, it says something like, may the innate unrest be stilled. And I really feel that line really strongly. It's like, yeah, what would that be like to not experience that constant kind of gnawing craving? So I think that's what's you know, in a way you could say this is a call on our imagination to think, to imagine what that would be like. And we can part of the way we can do that is we can hear about the Buddha, but we can also appreciate the qualities of the people who might be a little bit less craving than we are, you know what I mean, and actually really appreciate that. So again, in our puja we rejoice in merits. Hopefully we don't just do it in the puja, but other times as well. It's actually just appreciating the qualities that people have brought into being through their own efforts to, you know, to reduce or even eradicate craving from their own mind. And it's really significant, I think, that in this verse, he talks about relinquishing. He says, the giving up and relinquishing of it, the craving, non-reliance of it. And he talks about freedom. So even though it comes across as a bit negative, there is, he talks about freedom from it, freedom from craving. And, this giving up and relinquishing. And this is what's so hard, isn't it? To just let go of things that we think will provide us with security. What popped into my mind, actually, when I was writing this, was, the image of the monkey with his hand in the story I heard was that if you want to catch a monkey, what you do is you put a bit of salt in a hole, and monkeys really like salt, apparently, and they put the monkey puts his or her hand in the hole, and because the hand is clenched, the monkey can't get the hand out, and then you can catch them. Now, I don't know if that's zoologically accurate, but that's the story. I looked it up online. There's loads about it online. One thing I looked up, it was explaining the meaning of Luke 10:18, the story of the monkey. but I think it's quite that holding on actually is the thing that gets us into trouble. And what we need to do, which is so hard, is just let go. I'll say a bit more about that when we come to the path. So not only do we need a vivid sense of the Buddha, but a vivid sense that's a possibility for us. I think that's what can happen if you start really thinking about the Buddha, really reflecting on the Buddha, that you start feeling more like, oh yeah, I'm a human being, I can do this. So that is Shraddha. That's what's sometimes known as faith or confidence or trust. And one of these different kinds of faith or confidence and trust, and one of them is faith in capacities. So it's not just the faith that the Dharma is true. It's not just the faith that the Buddha had awakened qualities, but the faith that we have that capacity, we have that seed in our own heart. And I think that's probably maybe what, Philip Larkin didn't have. He didn't have that kind of experience, so he just had the kind of bleakness of it. Also in the tradition, there are, in the Pali tradition, in the Theravadin tradition, there are a number of positive synonyms for nirvana, for awakening, for the cessation of craving. So I just thought I'd finish this section on the third noble truth by just reading those to you. There's 33 of them. So the uninclined, the taintless, the truth, the far shore, the subtle, the very difficult to see, the unaging, the stable, the undisintegrating, the unmanifest, the unproliferated, the peaceful, the deathless, the sublime, the auspicious, the secure, the cessation of craving, the wonderful, the amazing, the unailing state, nirvana, the unafflicted, the emancipated, the pure, the free, the unattached, the island, the shelter, the refuge, the going to the far shore. So it gives you a sense of what's being spoken of here. So that's the third noble truth. And the fourth is the path, or the way. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this noble eightfold path that is perfect view, perfect intention, perfect speech, perfect action, perfect livelihood, perfect effort, perfect mindfulness, and perfect concentration. So I'm not going to be able to talk about all of those. You might be relieved to hear that. But if you are interested and it is a really important Buddhist teaching, I'd really recommend a series of talks that Sangharakshita gave in 1968, which has been, it's in a book now called The Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, but it's just an absolutely fantastic exposition of the of a teaching that can often be presented in quite a dry, glib, dead kind of way. But he actually he really brings out the inner meaning of it. So I'm just going to say a few things about it. The first thing to say is, and again, this we can sort of forget this, that marga, this or magga, is means path or way. So that's an image. The other truths are like, you know, dukkha, that's an experience, craving, it's a mental state, cessation, that's another kind of mental state or another experience, you could sort if you can call it an experience. But this is an image. And it's a really important image in kind of human life, the image of a path. So, you know, whatever we do in life, we're involved in moving along a path, literally. So to get home, I have to walk up Gardner Street. It's a path. But then, of course, there's all these myths of journeys, you know, like Ulysses, for example, which is obviously an important myth for this city. And again, if you look at Western art, again and again and again, you see images of a path. I was just reminded, I don't know why, I'm going to New Zealand next week. I keep thinking of things about New Zealand when I was writing this, but on my grandparents' wall, there was a photo of a gravel road, black and white photo, not very big, in a frame, leading into the Southern Alps. So, you know, that thing where the road gets smaller and smaller, it disappears into the horizon. And I really loved that photo when I was a kid. I was kind of captivated by it. There's something about that image which is really potent and speaks to something really deep within human beings. And that's why there's so many stories about journeys. You know, Ulysses or, you know, the Odyssey being one of the more ancient ones. But there's any number of them in whatever period of history you care to look at. What this image is, is an image, or at least it's an image of joining up, if you like, the state of dukkha and craving with the state of freedom from dukkha and craving. That's what a path is, isn't it? It's like you enter into a path to get from here to there, and that is there. So that, you know, it's talked about as you know, another image is that the far shore. You know, you're going somewhere else. And from our perspective, that's what it feels like, doesn't it? It feels like enlightenment is somewhere else. And yet, we can have a vision of it. So what I am going to talk about in terms of the Eightfold Path is just this idea of vision and transformation. So the first aspect of the path is perfect vision. So we actually have a direct experience or understanding or inclination or intimation of the truth of the possibility of awakening for us. In whatever way that arises, that's what happens, and that's the represented by the first limb of perfect view or perfect vision, drishti. And the other seven is like the working out of that in the different aspects of our life. So our first of all, it's intention. In other words, our emotional life, then speech, the whole realm of communication, and then there's action. What we say and what we do. There's livelihood, how we earn our living. There's perfect effort, which is like a sort of just the basic progression from unskillful to skillful mental states. There's mindfulness and awareness, and there's concentration or gathering ourselves together, becoming more integrated. So where that starts is with perfect emotion or perfect intention. And it's interesting to note that the very first aspect of that is non-desire. So the very first thing we need to cultivate is we need to actually work on, according to this teaching, to integrate that vision into a whole of our life. We need to work on that instinct to hold on and to grab. So it also means non-desire, means, you know, renunciation, giving up or giving away. And in his talk on this, Sundarakshita Bhante says, it's quite a good question, really. He says, well, you know, one thing you can ask yourself is, since you've become a Buddhist, what have you given up? It's quite a pokey question in a way. What have you given up? Now, you know, it's easy to think of that in a kind of Lent kind of way, like, well, you know, chocolate, I don't drink wine. But what about, like, you know, attachment to kind of like, to being, you know, in a kind of comfy environment with other people that are kind of don't challenge you. There's all sorts of other, what about status, the desire for status? What about all these other kind of cravings and longings that we have that provide a kind of a solve to our insecurity? What about those? What can we give up those? So yeah, so in terms of perfect intention, they're spoken of as being your non-desire, non-hate and non-cruelty. To put positively, it's dana, so generosity. And I think this kind of, again, it gives a slightly different, so rather than giving up, it's like giving away, which is, I find a bit more interesting, a bit more appealing in a way. So, you know, the actual thing of not just giving things up, but actually giving things away, like just turning that around. So that rather than bringing things in, which is a craving impulse, so sometimes it's talked about as selfish craving, in a way it's going in the other direction. So that's the kind of basic shift that we need to make of rather than bringing everything into us and holding on to it, we need to turn that around and give it away and let go of it. And that's at the absolute kind of cutting edge of the whole process of the path of transformation, is making that shift within our mind. Just for the sake of completeness, that also positively includes the four Brahma Viharas, so metta, karuna, or compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upekkha, or equanimity, and also shraddha. Again, so faith comes in, actually staying faithful to that vision. So, just coming towards the end now. So basically, what happens, and this is where I'm getting into the notion of truth, is what happens when the Buddha's communicating these teachings for the first time to these five companions. Somebody gets it. Somebody understands. And what happens when that understanding arises? It says, this is what the Blessed One said. Elated, the bhikkhus of the group of five delighted in the Blessed One's statement. And while this discourse was being spoken, there arose in the Venerable Kandanya the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. Whatever is subject to origination is subject to cessation. Just like a light bulb goes on. But and what happens then is this shout goes up of as a sort of sadhu, this shout of delight goes up through all the heaven realms. The whole of the whole cosmos kind of reverberates with celebration. And it says, and when the wheel of the Dhamma had been set in motion by the Blessed One, the earth-dwelling devas raised a cry. At Varanasi in the deer park, at Isipatana, the unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. Having heard the cry of the earth-dwelling devas, the devas of the realm of the four great king raised a cry. And so on, it goes up to all the different sort of strata of these different god realms. And then it says, thus at that moment, at that instant, at that second, the cry spread as far as the Brahma world, that's the highest god realm, and this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked and trembled, and an immeasurable glorious radiance appeared in the world, surpassing the divine majesty of the gods. Then the Blessed One uttered this inspired utterance. Kandanya has indeed understood. Kandanya has indeed understood. In this way, the Venerable Kandanya acquired the name Anya Kandanya. Kandanya, who has understood. So, the speaking of truth is a powerful thing. I think this is what this is saying. Just saying something that's true has an effect in and of itself. It doesn't require any reason. It just, in and itself, is a positive, liberating thing. I don't think we see it like that. We often take a utilitarian view to truth. It's like, well, what can I do with it? What can I get with it? How will it help me? But no, what's being said here is just the utterance, the communication of truth, particularly if it's done by a recently awakened Buddha, is just a powerfully transformative thing in and of itself. And I know that, weirdly, even hearing about dukkha is weirdly liberating. I remember when I first heard the Four Noble Truths, I found it such a relief that actually, yeah, it's kind of difficult. Life's kind of difficult. And that's kind of weirdly kind of okay. Once you feel like it shouldn't be otherwise, once you don't feel aggrieved or feel like someone's gone wrong or someone's to blame, then you just get on with doing what you need to do to free yourself from that. So again, in the Dhammapada, it says, difficult is the attainment of the human state. Difficult is the life of mortals. Difficult is the hearing of the real truth. Difficult is the appearance of the enlightened ones. And that is, I don't know about you, but I find that strangely reassuring. It's like, yeah, actually, it is kind of difficult. It's amazing, I notice so often when you teach meditation and people talk, they're so reassured and so relieved that everyone else finds it difficult too. It's amazing to see that again and again. It's such a relief. Oh, yeah, it is. It's just difficult. It's just difficult. I mean, most things that are really worth doing are difficult. And meditation and Dharma practice is no exception. So I'm just going to finish I'm going to read this sonnet, a poem from Bhante. It's a bit challenging. So I thought, geez, no, it's not a very inspiring note to end on. But I'm going to end on it anyway, and hopefully you won't hate me too much. So this is just called Sonnet, yeah? And it's by Sangharakshita. Reading some books, you'd think the Buddha way, as though macadamized, ran smooth and straight. Straight as an arrow, billboards left and right. And that the yellow buses, thrice a day, whirled past the milestones whose smug faces say, Nirvana, 15 miles. By 10 tonight, you'll all be there, good people, and alight outside the Peace Hotel where you're to stay. But those who read their own hearts, inly wise, know that the way's a hacked path, roughly made through densest jungle, deep in the unknown. And that, though burn 1,000 baleful eyes like death lamps round, serene and unafraid, man through the hideous dark must plunge alone.